Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media, Troy, New York. I'm Chris Scully.
And I'm Erica. Today we're joined by Extinction Rebellion members who were arrested in last Thursday's demonstration in Times Square.
Then artist Becca Van Kay talks about her exhibition, Feel Me.
And later on, a new episode of Women in STEM.
After that, an interview with Mato'aka Little Eagle on Indigenous Peoples Day.
Finally, an interview with human rights lawyer Marlon Bowden, and here are some headlines.
The Times Union reports that a former Emma Willard student who was allegedly raped by a teacher at the school prompted her to push for passage of the state's Child Victims Act, saying she's donating a billboard she rented for the cause to the family of Edson Thevenin, the 37-year-old shot and killed by a Troy police sergeant in 2016. This has enabled Thevenin's family to post a series of questions about his killing on an electronic billboard over the Corning Preserve on Interstate 787.
The public is asked to join a national renowned expert on recycling and waste reduction, Dr. Neil Seldman, today, October 14th, and tomorrow, October 15th. Dr. Seldman will present two programs, a lecture on how the Capital District can transition from landfills and incineration today, October 14th at 6 p.m., a workshop creating a zero-waste plan will be conducted on Tuesday, October 15th at 6 p.m., and will include municipal leaders. Both events will be at the Albany Public Library on Washington Avenue and are free and open to the public. Seldman's work with the Capital District officials and residents is sponsored by the Zero Waste Capital District Coalition, which includes the League of Women Voters of Albany County.
Michigan State Senator Jeff Irwin introduced a bill last week to replace Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day. Michigan is among an increasing number of states trying to do away with Columbus Day in support of Native Americans. The second Monday in October has traditionally been a federal holiday commemorating Christopher Columbus, but a growing number of Americans believe the holiday celebrates genocide and ignores the peoples that were here before Columbus arrived. At least seven states and Washington, D.C. have already made the switch.
In light of the recent controversies of police violence, Mayor Madden of Troy will be selecting members to be put on the Police Objective Review Committee, or PORC. The committee falls short of having the subpoena power recently demanded by citizens outraged by the perceived unaccountability of Troy police. Mayor Madden is accused by many in the city of covering up for the murder of Edson Thevenin by Sergeant Randall French of the Troy Police Department in April of 2016. After an interval investigation proven that Sergeant French acted recklessly, lied under oath, and shot Edison unnecessarily, was leaked to the family of Mr. Thevenin and published by the Times Union, Mayor Madden is accused of purchasing another review, which allegedly refutes the internal investigation based on psychological arguments. But this review has yet to be made public. Those interested in applying for the review committee must submit a resume and written statement as to why they want to serve on the oversight committee to the mayor's office by mail or email. More information is available at troynewyork.gov.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more about this program and the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Last Thursday, Extinction Rebellion activists blocked the intersection of Broadway and West 44th Street in New York City, the busiest intersection in Times Square. 62 people were arrested by refusing to leave the intersection. We're speaking now with who were arrested last week.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hello.
Hi.
Should we introduce ourselves?
Please.
Okay. I'm Dave Pablo, a sometime co-host here.
I'm Jack McGuy.
I'm Francis McGuy, also sometimes co-host.
And I'm Jesse Marshall. It's great to be here.
So, what are the principles of nonviolent resistance, and why is XR committed to nonviolence?
Sure, I can take that. This is Jesse. So the basic idea behind nonviolent resistance is that people who have been shut out of normal avenues of power because they don't have the money or access to the political system have this other form of power, which is basically the ability to not comply with the rules of the game as they're set out. So we can use our bodies to basically get in the way and shut down business as usual. And when it comes to the climate crisis, it's kind of too late for anything but shutting down business as usual any way we can.
And so how did you practice passive resistance during this specific demonstration?
This is Jack. We glued, well, the three of us here glued and chained ourselves to a brightly colored boat, sailboat that was brought into the intersection, which took a long time to get us all detached from. And so it just created a disturbance and a, you know, something that was photogenic, as well as just sort of shutting down the normal flow of commerce and traffic there in Times Square.
And the majority of the arrestees simply sat around the boat as everyone was, as the people who were getting chained and glued to it, glued and chained themselves to it.
And how did you practice passive resistance during the demonstration?
Well, I mean, just our presence essentially was passive resistance, as has already been described. The intent was both to make a visual, iconic gesture that would be carried by local, regional, national, international news media, and that was successful in that respect. And also, this was part of a larger action by all the various branches of Extinction Rebellion, which started in the UK but has spread to the United States and other countries, and specifically to New York City and also to the capital region here.
So you all were arrested for this, correct?
Yes.
And yep. Were the charges or the way that you were treated after being arrested different for those that actually glued or chained themselves to the boat?
Yes, they were. Basically, the people who were sitting around the boat were given one or two violations and then released shortly after their arrest. And when I say shortly, we're talking within 6 hours or so, depending on different circumstances. But then the others of us who were locked were also given a misdemeanor, and we were held for approximately 32 hours in the bulk of that in what's known as the Tombs, and that's central booking in New York City.
And what was your, like, experiences?
This is Jack. I found it really kind of rewarding and fascinating to meet up with people who, on the face of it, seemed like you know, the people who've been in and out of the system, and who my only other association with these people are the stereotypes that I've picked up from TV and movies. And so to start talking with these people and to sort of connect with them on a one-to-one human basis was pretty amazing. It was a very challenging situation in a lot of ways, but I felt like for me it was rewarding overall for that reason.
This is Francis. For me, it was very interesting. It was a rewarding experience in that I got to spend like several uninterrupted hours with a group of almost 40 men without their phones, which is like a very unique experience these days. I just got to talk about like what it means to be a man or labeled by the state as a man, and like how this movement is grappling with the issues of climate change and the climate crisis, how we're feeling about that. And honestly, like the whole experience of being in jail for a while was not as difficult as I expected it to be. The cops were incredibly gracious and chatty, actually, and the food was better than I thought it would be.
You had mentioned earlier before we went on air, Dave, that the experiences that you had were pleasant, but that you had that wasn't necessarily the case for everyone. Like the people were in the tombs, so the people who had risked higher arrests were not necessarily locked up with other activists from the same action.
So that's an interesting topic, and more than one of us probably want to weigh in on that one. But essentially, when we first got there, we were put as a group, and there were seven of us. And this is, you know, the men. There, so in terms of the people that locked themselves to the boat, seven were men, five were women, and of course they were put in separate places. But
and one teenager.
Oh. Oh, right. But the teenager was released within 3 hours.
Yeah.
Right. But we were confined in different spaces. But at first, we wondered whether it was a racial thing because the seven of us were white. And then basically we were put in one cell. And then across the way, there were other people who were there for other issues. And they at first seemed to be mostly actually exclusively black and Latino. And then we, over time, they would bring others in with us, and but bring others to the other cell. And it's still not completely clear as to why it was partitioned that way, except that some of the people in the other cell seemed to be there probably for longer term because their violations were greater. And one of our number, this guy Steve, was the first one of us called up. And they called up another person from the other cell across the way at the same time. They were then put in a holding cell to wait for a little while to talk to attorneys. And in that time span, the guy who Steve was paired with actually got violent with him, was slap punching him and kicking him. And Steve is apparently a black belt. So he mainly tried to defuse the situation, not escalate it. But it was a somewhat traumatic experience for him. And maybe some of us want to comment on the conditions of the cells themselves and just, you know, share what that was like.
I would love to do that. So, yeah, we spent about 30 hours in a jail cell, two stories underground, no windows, fluorescent lights on all the time, temperature maybe like 50 degrees, 55. Jack is mouthing. He's pretty precise about these kinds of things. No beds, not even enough benches actually for us all to sleep on a bench. And a diet mostly of peanut butter sandwiches and Cheerios for four meals straight. So we did get, you know, from our, you know, we're all white and relatively privileged. We got, in our limited way, a taste of what this system does to people. And there were things about it that were really tough. You know, we didn't get water for about half a day. There was just what struck me was just an overall feeling like you couldn't trust anything that anyone in a position of power said to you. That it was all you could really trust was that either they were making it up or they were not telling you the truth.
I think one of the things that we all benefited from was that, you know, over time they did bring more people into the cells with us, and we were exposed to people's circumstances that we otherwise wouldn't have seen. I had a similar experience when I was locked up there in 2012 for a similar environmental protest. Just seeing people from underprivileged areas or people who'd gotten themselves in circumstances that they really couldn't quite digest, and you would see their stories evolve over the time that they were spending in the cell with us.
But then through it all, always lots of laughter and always a lot of solidarity and support away from it. Within, even in this, you know, two floors underground in a totally kind of oppressive situation, people still just coming together and helping each other out.
Right, and also despite many people coming off of a really traumatic and self-induced toxicity, still a lot of humanity came through.
Well, thanks so much for coming on the radio and speaking about your experience. Is Extinction Rebellion planning any more actions in the coming months?
We will be. We've got nothing specific yet, but you can check out our website, at xrcr.life to find out more. And we have lots of talks and trainings coming up to prepare you all for things in the streets.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Filmy was a multimedia, multi-sensory art installation that was finished up. It's run at ColorWorks in Troy. WOAC correspondent Aaron Pettinotti went there on opening night and talked with artist Becca Van Kay about her exhibition, which paired quilted images to recordings of house and techno music that she listened to while she wove them.
This is Aaron Pednati, and I am at a multimedia art exhibition in Troy at ColorWorks called Feel Me, and I am interviewing Becca Van Kay about her exhibition, which is a multisensory exhibition that involves quilted visual patterns and recorded music. Basically, you walk up and you look at the picture and you listen to the music on headphones, and that involves some sort of device like a phone or an...
I'm just using an iPod for this exhibition. Each piece, there are three pieces that have music associated with them with two iPods. Like, the two that are on the same wall have one iPod. And yeah, then you can just pick it up and stand directly in front of the piece and just be absorbed into the experience of, like, the symbiosis between the visual patterns and the repetitious dance music.
Okay, so you sort of already addressed my first question. The experience that I had was I walked up, I put on the headphones, and I looked at the art on the walls, and the art is typically made of multicolored yarn, and it was this interesting experience in which I'm looking around at all of the patterns that you've woven into the visual fabric that I'm looking at, and I'm listening to music at the same time. And despite the fact that the pattern is static and frozen on the canvas, there is a quality of rhythm. There's a quality of music. And I feel the rhythms of the music expressing themselves through the visual art that I'm perceiving. So that is clearly not a coincidence, right? That's a part of your artistic process. So can you just talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, totally. So that, like, what you're explaining is exactly my intention. That's what I hope to translate with my pieces. So when I'm making the works, I'm always listening to house and techno mixes. And what I do is just get into this trance, essentially, where it's like a meditative rhythm, and I want the pieces to essentially pulsate, and each piece has one song associated with it that I think, like, what you're seeing is representing the rhythms that I'm experiencing with my body, because I think music is so ephemeral. We have so little language to actually describe how it makes us feel, and it's also so personal. And so this is just my experience of these songs. And so I'm glad that that's coming across in some way.
So how would you account for this process whereby something musical gets translated into something visual? Because if you're sitting there weaving as you listen, there's not a totally conscious, this is how I'm going to represent that musically thing going on there. There's some sort of unconscious translation of the musical rhythms. What do you think is going on there?
Well, I'm totally blanking on the term for it, but there are people who see music as colors. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Synesthesia.
Yeah, synesthesia. And I don't think I have synesthesia exactly, but I do. Maybe I, like, have it on some level, because what I see is what I'm hearing, essentially. And that I don't really have any more language to describe the reasons I make color decisions. All I know is that I have a really strong sense of color, and I have a very loud sense of color in the way that I make color combination choices is very deliberate but subconscious at the same time. I don't know how to describe. Yeah, it's just like half the time I'll peel off a layer of yarn because that's not looking the way I want it to look, but I don't have any other language to describe why it looks right or doesn't look right. But in the end, I just want to have these vibrations, visual vibrations.
but something in the nature of what you're hearing is translating into something in the nature of what I'm seeing. Yes. That is definitely coming through. And that was a big part of the phenomenology of the experience for me. Like, I felt the rhythms of the music in the visual art. And that was, there's something really remarkable about that. And there was also this thing where, you know, different songs that you were playing had different rhythms to them, and the songs were correlated to the particular work of art that I was looking at, and I could feel the rhythms of those particular songs in that particular work of art. So I think that what you're producing, we don't really have a word for exactly what's going on there, but there's something pretty profound at an ontological level in your art. Your thoughts on that?
I mean, that's, I think, one of the greatest compliments I've ever received. Because, yeah, I feel like that's present in pretty much every aspect of my practice. Like, even with the other works on the wall, which are tactile fabric collages, essentially. I think, as it relates specifically to the works that you are most interested in, I'm also just translating the kind of motion that I get in, the action of actually creating the works, which is in itself repetitious. Like, I'm just doing the same thing over and over again. And so I think in some way that comes across in the visual representation in this weird way. I mean, I guess a lot of handwork, which is partially what this is, it's like an immediate visual representation of a repetitious act. And that, I think, goes really hand in hand with house and techno because of that persistent bass beat that is just always there. Even if you're making other types of creative decisions, there are constants. And so I think it lends itself really well to that. I don't know if I answered your question. Probably.
You did, but I also would opine that I don't think that what's going on is simply a translation of an underlying rhythm into a visual form, because there's difference along with the repetition. Yeah. There are multiple patterns that emerge. So it's like in your own way, you're creatively riffing on that underlying beat. You're doing something of your own with it, and the way that that manifests at the level of the visual art translates. It comes through, but also changes. Like, it's not just a direct translation. There's some kind of adaptation that's going on as well.
Definitely. Well, I think what just came to mind is what else I like to do with the music is obviously go out and dance. So I'll go to a rave and I'll be out from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. And what goes with every different song is you kind of do a different dance to every song. So I feel like that's sort of another version. I'm kind of doing a dance with the song.
Mm-hmm. Or even when you're listening to the same song, you change up your mood.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. It's like totally mood dependent, energy dependent. And so you'll probably get a different result each time. Yeah. It's also quite interesting because I'm a very detail oriented, schedule oriented person in every aspect of my life, with the exception of my artwork. It's the place where I am most off the cuff and spontaneous. And I think that lends itself to this type of practice, that to be in touch with my emotions and my headspace.
Well, that cognitive and affective translation definitely comes through. Thanks very much for this interview, and best of luck with the rest of the exhibition, which is going on till when?
I think it's October 12th. But I think it is mid-October. But yeah, it's going to be up for a month and some change, and we have more events coming up.
So I totally recommend that people listening to this come out and see it, because it is a compelling and very interesting experience.
It's also free.
And free. Great.
Thank you so much for inviting me to be on the show.
My pleasure.
And that was Call It Works Radio with host Aaron Pettinati and artist Becca Van Kay.
For those just tuning in, I'm Erica.
And I'm Christopher Skelly. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to find out about the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also be soon to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region. It is the time of the week for women in STEM. On this episode, Sophia Callenheim talks to Professor Marlene Belfort about her research and experiences in biology as well as being a woman in STEM.
This is Sophia Cahaline, and I am with Professor Marlene Belfort from the University of Albany, where she researches and teaches biology. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to have you here.
So I wanted to start off with some questions about STEM in general and how you first got interested in biology.
So I've always been interested in biology, but I didn't know that I would be a professor of biology or biochemistry. There were lots of other things that I thought I'd like to do. But somehow, after getting a BS degree in South Africa, I decided to go to graduate school in molecular biology in California. And I've been doing it ever since.
So did you grow up in South Africa?
So yes, I was born and raised in Cape Town.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a beautiful city.
Never been.
Yeah, so I'm actually going back there in December. My husband and I are both graduates of the University of Cape Town, UCT, and the university is giving us honorary doctorates, so we'll go back and, party.
Wow. Well, that's exciting. Good luck to you.
Yeah.
Can you give an overview of just kind of what you're studying or researching right now in the field of biology?
Sure. So, first of all, we work on microbes mainly, and mainly bacteria, and we're interested in what turns their genes on and shuts them off. We're also interested in pieces of DNA that mobilize themselves on the genome are important in such things as drug resistance. They carry the genes for drug resistance.
So will this research help maybe eventually lead to preventing bacteria from getting this resistance to drugs? Or?
So we actually do have some projects that relate to antimicrobials, which stop the growth of bacteria. So we can actually kill bacteria because the gene in which this mobile DNA is found can no longer function.
That could be really helpful.
So various bacteria and fungi also have these elements. And we've shown that one of the compounds can actually stop the growth of mycobacteria, which cause tuberculosis, and also stop the growth of fungi because of these anti-intine compounds. And one of them is actually a compound that you may have heard of. It's called cisplatin, which is an anti-cancer agent.
I haven't heard of it, but...
Okay, yeah. So... it interacts with the intine and freezes this mobile DNA in place so that the gene in which it resides won't function. And since the function is important for the survival of the microbe, the compounds kill the microbe.
It's war. That's what that is.
Yes.
So moving a bit away from the science, I noticed that you received the Alice Evans Award. Can you tell me a bit more about that? And I know it relates kind of nicely.
Okay. Well, so the...
Kind of nicely.
Okay. Well, so the Alice Evans Award, I think, is a mentoring award, and it's particularly directed at mentoring women, although I enjoy mentoring men and women. And I do that at various stages, everything from undergraduate through graduate, postdoc. assistant professors, and I even have an associate professor who is now being promoted to full professor, whom I have mentored. And in the process of doing this, we formed a group on campus called WISH, which is stands for Women in Science and Health. And WISH is an organization of female faculty who meet on a monthly basis, communicate regularly, help support each other, support students. And yeah, it's part of what I do that I really enjoy.
It's great. So WISH is specifically here at UAlbany, or is it also around other colleges?
Yeah, so it's specifically here at UAlbany, but it's on all of the Albany campuses. So it's involves people on the health sciences campus across the Hudson. It involves women in biomedical sciences, which is part of the New York State Department of Health and has campuses downtown, and then women on the uptown campus. And we like to include men in our activities as well for a whole bunch of reasons.
I can think of one as just being like sharing experiences, really, just kind of how women might be perceived and letting others know it's like this is a problem sometimes that we have to face, which I kind of wanted to get into. Have you ever experienced from your peers at any point in the fields implicit or unconscious biases?
So it's interesting. Very rarely have I felt that I was being discriminated against because I was a woman. And I often wonder why that's true. And I think it is because I went to an all-girls school for 12 years, from K through high school. And all sorts of good and bad things happened in that school. And they all resulted from interactions with women. So I didn't ever attribute bad things happening to interactions with men. Mm-hmm. So I've just never felt it. And I think that's the reason.
You can just see everyone kind of doing these things or not doing that.
Yes,
and it's just,
exactly. Okay. You know, there were leaders, there were losers, there were all kinds of people, and it wasn't related to gender. And there was discrimination, and it wasn't related to gender.
Yeah, it's kind of... It definitely depends on how you grew up and where you grew up and all that. So that's pretty cool that you were able to figure this out.
Maybe I'm just thick-skinned.
could be. So just to finish up, I was wondering if you had a message that you might want to share with young girls who are interested in STEM or in biology in particular.
Yes. So if they have a propensity for science, I recommend it. So there are those who think that it's a very intense profession and so it's not consistent with a wholesome family life. I found that not to be the case. I worked very hard, but I managed to have three children while I was doing it, and they've grown up into wholesome people. So, it can be done, but it can't be done without dedication and focus and hard work and persistence.
For sure. Well, thank you very much for speaking to me about this.
You're welcome.
And that was Women in STEM with host Sophia Cahillane and Professor Marlene Belfort. If you want to learn more about this series, check out Sophia Cahillane's People Power page on the Sanctuary's website at www.mediasanctuary.org/peoplepower.
the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Network Roman Labor correspondent Willie Terry attended HVCC Voices Library Lecture Series. The continuing impact of government boarding schools of generations of Native Americans, with the guest speaker, Moto'a'oaka, hope I pronounced that right, Little Eagle, on Wednesday, October 8th at Hudson Valley Community College. In this part two segment, you will hear his interview with Moto'a'oaka, Little Eagle, about his her views of Columbus Day, in which she calls an indigenous people's day.
Ooh, no. What I want to ask you, too, is about Columbus.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I know you.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, it's coming up on Monday is Columbus Day.
Yep. You mean Indigenous Day?
Indigenous, yeah. Indigenous Native American Day.
That's it.
Right.
And also coming up in November is Native American Month, just so you know.
Right. Now, I just want you to tell, what would you like to tell people, you know, who don't know a lot about this and still have that Columbus perspective in their mind?
I would like to say that it's really the system that has educated people to honor Columbus. And that's because, of course, the government wants people to be proud of the country that they are citizens of. However, a lot of things have been written in educational books, history books, fiction, children's stories that are at least misleading, if not out and out mistruths. And Columbus's myth is one of those things. And it's distressing to people, particularly of Italian descent, to learn that somebody that maybe they have honored in the past was not such a good guy. And I understand that. However, it's also very important to understand how the indigenous population of this country has been treated throughout history. Because, you know, there was a point even back in the 1500s, where there was a Columbus was thinking that it was okay to torture natives and cut off their hands and their feet and enslave them, do all of this, burn them over green wood, hang them over green wood, things like that, or invite chiefs to go to a hut for a peaceful meeting to resolve differences and then burn the hut with everybody inside. He was thinking that that was okay because, well, Native people weren't really people anyway. They really weren't human. And so it took a decree from a pope. Lives depended on somebody across the ocean, a pope, saying that Native people were human beings. And so Columbus, by his own words, said things like, these people are gentle and kind and generous. And with 50 men, we could subdue them and make them slaves. There's a good book called Columbus's Enterprise, mm-hmm. Exploding the Myth by Hans Koenig. And it's a good book to learn about Columbus. Okay. And it's quick reading. I suggest it for everybody. Okay. A lot of history has been based on Europeans' perspective of who Native people are. And this began with that guy who got lost in the Caribbean, you know, that gets celebrated by some people on October 12th. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and he himself talks about what he did. You know, he came over here not to spread the word of God, really, although you read that. He came over here. He was on a business trip, okay? He had four voyages over here, and he came over here to see what riches he could find, because he was really on the way to India and China. He lied to King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella and told them that there was so much gold over here and, you know, all these wonderful spices and all this wonderful stuff. And there was alluvial gold, which means little nuggets of gold that you pan for. But he made the native people pan for this gold. And if they did not fill a hawk's bell full of gold within 3 months, he would chop off their hands. I mean, Columbus was a very bad guy. He would roast native people over green wood, and he'd put sticks in their mouth because, oh, gee, their screaming was disturbing his soldiers. You know, Columbus was a very bad guy, and I'm so happy that many people have decided that October 12th is Indigenous Day. Yes. Okay. Gee whiz, I'm getting worked up here.
Now, you have an event coming up. So tell us something about the event that's coming up and how people could get there.
Yes. In New Paltz, on October 19th, there is going to be at Unison Arts Center a program that's called Native America, Old and New. And it's a two-hour program. Doors open at 7:30, and the program begins at 8. This program is so special, and this whole evening is about healing and the resiliency of the human spirit and continuity and respect.
Just one last question, and I'm going to be finished with you. Because this is very important, like all over the country, all over the world, people are fighting climax, you know, there's change, you know, the world is changing based on what people are doing to the earth. And I know Native Americans have a special relation, have a special thoughts about Mother Earth. Mm-hmm. So could you just give me your point of view on that?
Well, we have one planet, one earth. We've not been good to this planet. This planet has been so forgiving. But now, our mother, this earth, that nurtures every living creature, this earth is tired, and she needs our help. We need our rainforests. We need to protect them. Our medicines, so many medicines yet undiscovered, are there. So many beautiful creatures are there. Indigenous people who have lived in the rainforest forever. We cannot eliminate them or the animals or the trees. We cannot pollute the waters. We cannot do this to the earth. We are damaging ourselves.
we are damaging the next generations. We cannot leave them with not having good air to breathe or food that is poisonous. We cannot do that to the children who are coming up. It is not fair. And to turn a blind eye to what science says is going on, we can no longer do that. It's now time. We have to stop whatever denying is going on out there, work with other countries to limit the pollution that goes into the air, and do what we can do to stop the plastic pollution. I'm so glad that many stores have started a no plastic bag policy. And we have to protect our waters and the creatures in them. We have to protect everything. It is time. We can no longer abuse this land or anything, any of the elements that bring us life. We can't. We have to honor that. That's what the Creator wants. He wants us to honor these amazing blessings that He gives us.
All right, thank you, Metoka, Little Eagle.
Thank you to Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Willie Terry and to Metoka Little Eagle for a great interview.
HMM correspondent Alexis spoke with Marlon Bowden, a lawyer and an anti-war, anti-death penalty, anti-slavery activist. Born in Honduras, she has immigrated to the U.S. at the age of 7 with her family. Marlon talks about human rights and Indigenous People Day.
We're speaking with Marlon Bowden, who is a lawyer with the Legal Aid Society in New York City, the nation's oldest law firm for the poor. She's also the author of Arrows of Fire and The Wedding Gift. You're an expert in human rights abuses, and on today, Columbus Day or Indigenous Peoples Day, that is certainly a hot topic, Louisiana being the latest state to recognize October 14th as Indigenous Peoples Day. Marlon, could you tell us, in your opinion, was Christopher Columbus a bad person?
Yes, he was a very bad person. But the issue for us today is not just that we know today that he was a bad person. The Catholic Church and the Spanish Crown knew that he was a bad person, as were all the conquistadors, in 1515, at least 1515. They knew this because there was a Spanish priest, I'm sure you've heard of him, named Bartolomé de las Casas, who at that time was in Cuba, and he had initially participated in massacres of the native people, but then he had a change of heart about that, specifically about the native people, not about African people. And he left his post in 1515 and went back to Spain to speak with the Council of the Indies and the Crown's representatives to say that they needed to stop the conquerors from killing and raping and otherwise abusing the native people. So everyone in Spain, and especially the Crown and the Council of Indies, they were already on notice that all of these conquerors, including Columbus, were very bad people. So that's why when the Knights of Columbus pressured President Franklin Delano Roosevelt to create this federal holiday in honor of Columbus, that's surprising because de las Casas' writings criticizing the conquerors in the Catholic Church were published in 1875, and it was in the 1930s when the Knights of Columbus pressured the government to create this holiday, knowing full well that Columbus was criticized by his fellow conqueror and by the priest de las Casas in 1515.
For our listeners living in a state that still recognizes Columbus Day, how can we go about renaming Columbus Day in favor of Indigenous Peoples Day? And why is that important?
Right. So actually, New York City now celebrates Indigenous Peoples Day rather than Columbus Day. It was done in Louisiana, which a young Native American woman pressured the local government to celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day. And that's pretty much how it has happened around the country. So now we have 8 states that celebrate Indigenous Day. And I think now we have close to or more than actually 140 cities and towns that celebrate Indigenous Day. And all of those people did it by grassroots organizing, by pressuring their elected officials. One thing, unfortunately, though, that is happening is that while, you know, governmental entities, actually, and also universities and colleges, are recognizing, celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day, most are not actually abolishing Columbus Day. So that's, you know, quite an issue. And of course, it's still a federal holiday. But I actually think that at some point, the grassroots organizers are going to pressure the Congress to abolish Columbus Day.
For people who say that these human rights abuses, these murders and pillaging and enslavement that happened centuries ago, that we had no part of it, and if it were happening today, we would decide not to do that. What would you say to people who think that this history is not still relevant to the present?
I think that's a good question. What I say is that Native Americans, if we're going to focus on Columbus Day, then we need to focus on the lives of Native Americans today. And the history to their lives today is relevant because they actually have a very high rate of poverty. They actually have a very high rate of unemployment. So to me, the fact that you're honoring the person who set the conquest in motion of the New World when Native Americans are suffering today, I think it's kind of worse than a slap in the face. It's saying we actually don't care about the problems that you are facing today. And I think that abolishing Columbus Day is an important, it would be symbolic, yes, but it would be a very important move to say, let's acknowledge the lives of the Indigenous people today.
What are some things that we can do to celebrate Indigenous people?
Well, I think for myself, today I am not going to be able to go out and join a protest against Columbus Day, really. But I think that to the extent that we can do that, is a way to really, and when I say protest, I don't mean you have to go out there and start throwing things at people or whatever, defacing Columbus's statues or anything like that. But it's something that I have done before in New York City at the Columbus Day Parade. You know, just stand up there holding a sign. You're showing that you oppose Columbus Day and what Columbus stands for or stood for.
And just a note on terminology, Indigenous, Hispanic, Latino, what is the meaning and the proper usage of these terms?
Indigenous really refers to the people who were here before the European contact or European invasion. And so regardless of how long before that they were here first. So we refer to people all over the world who were there generally before the European contact as Indigenous. But you also, of course, have Indigenous people in Europe. So that's, you know, another issue. But, yeah, in the United States, that's going to refer to the First Nations. You've also heard them, or the tribes, the different tribes. Hispanic is a term that's really going out of use. The younger people have created the term Latinx, to refer to the people from Latin America and the Caribbean who have some sort of culture, usually language is the identifying characteristic, ancestry to the Spanish language. So that would be Latinx, because Latino, literally in Spanish, Latino only refers to the male people from Latin America. So the young people are now using Latinx to include, obviously, female as well as male.
And just one more question. It's important to recognize the struggles of Indigenous peoples, not just today, but all year round, because it does continue. What are some struggles that you have your eye on right now, whether they be in the courts or in the news or what have you?
I think the problem of poverty and access to education and employment, I think those are the issues that I focus on because of who my clients are all poor people. So, you know, that's one of the things that we constantly keep an eye on is what is happening across the country. And Native Americans or Indigenous people and African Americans have almost identical high unemployment and high poverty rates. And that's something that we need to keep putting pressure on our elected officials to do something about.
Marlon Bodden, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Marlon is a lawyer with the Legal Aid Society in New York City and author of The Wedding Gift and Arrows of Fire. And for Hudson Mohawk Magazine, I'm Alexis Goldsmith.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Christopher Skelly.
And I'm Erica. Our engineer tonight is Alexis Goldsmith. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 and 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
And as a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in helping with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or to stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.